You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Very evocative of the stolen generation, isn't it, in our context? Thanks, Margaret, and congratulations to those people who refrain from singing such a beautiful song. We'll now light our chalice. Let this flame remind us to be kind, to be helpful, to be loving. We recognise that it's not just words to be spoken. The chalice calls us into the practice of looking into our own hearts with courage and honesty. Welcome to today's service. Welcome to our regulars, to visitors, to everyone who chooses to be here. No matter what your identity or preference, your ethnicity or faith tradition, it's a space for thoughtfulness and kindness on a Sunday. We're not here to affirm the same beliefs, but to support each other in following our own path, any path that helps us create stronger communities, a world in which we embrace diversity, justice, democracy, and the interdependence of all living things. Unitarians have been meeting on Kaurna and Piramank lands for almost as long as the state of South Australia existed. We recognise the importance of Indigenous culture and language, and the authority of First Nations people in expressing and sharing their love for country for the benefit of us all. And we're going to sing a hymn today. The words will be up on the screen and you won't have any trouble with the tune. It's We Shall Overcome. The Story for All Ages is a new library book in Coventry Library, so I couldn't borrow it, so I stayed there and photographed it all. So today, you can be the readers. It's to my Wiradjuri people, First Nations peoples who have so much to teach, to share. We are Australians. We're the citizens of our family, school, classroom, community, church, team, street, suburb, country, town, state, world. As citizens of Australia, we have rights and we have responsibilities. But we're also part of something bigger. Australians, First Nations people, have lived and cared for country for tens of thousands of years. First Nations culture and knowledge live through songlines and are shared through dance, story, and celebration. Other citizens have travelled to make Australia their home. They've brought their own traditions and celebrations. Australia is unique, and so is what each of us brings to it. It's up to us to be part of the present and to act for the future, to know our history, to connect with the people who have lived here for thousands of generations, to acknowledge on whose land we walk, embrace the first languages of our place, connect to living, breathing country that holds memories and sustains us. Our treatment of the land will affect those yet to come. Stamp our feet, wake up the ancestors. Listen deeply to stories, to points of view, to country. Then treasure our differences and use our voices to speak up and stand together as citizens, as Australians. Statement was written 6 years ago, so I don't suppose anybody can remember it particularly, which is why I took the precaution of running off a copy. Sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and it coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise? That peoples possessed a land for 60 millennia, and this sacred link disappears from history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionally with the most incarcerated people on the planet, we're not innately criminal. Our children are aliened from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. And that was 6 years ago. I will open today's address with the words of the Reverend Winnie Gordon, a Unitarian minister from Birmingham in the UK. They were the words that I closed Black and White Part 1 with. We are all diverse, with various identities from various regions, cultures, heritages. When the conversation of race or racism happens, many make the accusation of division-mongering. But our identities are different. And as a spiritual community that believes in inclusivity, our job is to affirm those differences in a way that celebrates and uplifts the dignity and worth of every person. Beloved community is not formed by the eradication of difference, but by its affirmation, by each of us claiming the identities and cultural legacies that shape who we are and how we live in the world. We deepen those bonds by connecting with an anti-racist struggle. I pray we do. Well, that's how I ended Black and White Part 1, which was focused on countries of the Northern Hemisphere. The USA, the UK, France, and Germany. But the topic is equally relevant here, but with an extra twist. Many of our black people are indigenous, and that will be my focus, rather than on the very numerous immigrants from India, Africa, the Pacific Islands, and elsewhere. In today's story of all ages, a timeline was included in the back of the book. It means a lot to me because it coincides with my life. In 1967, I was still in high school and too young to vote when Australian citizens decided to include people in the census. Well, I had no idea until then that they weren't included. I'd lived in Ngadjuri, Bangala, Adnyamatna, Naranga, and Bawandik country and seen plenty of Aboriginal people. Mind you, at the time, there was only one of those Indigenous names I was aware of, and that was Bawandik, because that was on signage all around Mount Gambier, in contrast to Peterborough, Minipa, Lee Creek or Ardrossan, where there was no reference to tribal names, as we thought of those names then. I had Indigenous classmates in Minipa and Lee Creek, but not Peterborough or Ardrossan. Aboriginal people were rarely seen there. But Mount Gambier was the place where I was scolded by Mr. Shamira, a Youth Speaks for Australia adjudicator, for referring to Aboriginal people as Aboriginals. I was relegated to runner-up for the competition. Janet Elizabeth Spear won it. Your friend. The competition, Youth Speaks for Australia. Clearly, I had ignored the heck out of the adjudicator. It's an adjective, he said, not a noun. In my university years, the Aboriginal flag was flown for the first time. And I was scolded by fellow students in a psychology tutorial for saying that Aboriginal people didn't metabolise alcohol well. They were quite sure I was making it up to justify the racist practices in pubs and clubs and swimming pools around the country. I was somewhat affronted. I was a Charlie Perkins fan, and I knew about diabetes. But isn't it interesting how much heat fueled these exchanges? Clearly, there was a great deal of unspoken discomfort, a great deal of need to be right. And does not that speak of guilt? And while on that tack, I recall from my school days my favourite Australian poet, Judith Wright. Hugely loved by high school teachers and virtually ignored by universities. Let's look at a contemporary view of Wright in the 1950s. Vincent Buckley writes in Women Writers in Society. When Wright is content to be a woman, and during the profound incident of woman's life, she is able, paradoxically enough, to transcend her womanliness and be a very fine poet. When she attempts to be not a woman but a bard, commentator, or prophet, she becomes a bit of a shrew, which is the worst and most unwomanly thing that a woman may become. That Buckley could blithely call someone of Wright's stature a shrew is a reminder of what it was like for women who dared to write. But putting sexism aside, what else set Wright apart from her fellow poets? Here's an example, Bore a Ring. The song is gone. The dance is secret with the dancers in the earth. The ritual useless, and the tribal story lost in an alien tale. Only the grass stands up to mark the dancing ring. The apple gums posture and mime a past corroboree, murmur a broken chant. The hunter is gone. The spear is splintered underground. The painted bodies a dream the world breathed, sleeping and forgot. The nomad feet are still. Only the rider's heart halts at a sightless shadow, an unsaid word that fastens in the blood of the ancient curse, the fear as old as Cain. Her awareness of the land and the people of Australia stands out like Granny's tooth. Many of her contemporaries, including Vincent Buckley, followed the prescription of F.R. Leavis, the great critic quoted in almost every lecture by Professor John Colmer during my 3 years studying English at Adelaide University. And these prescriptions were grounded in the great tradition, the canon of Ing Lit. But Wright opened herself to the world. As publisher's reader at Jacaranda Press, she promoted the manuscript of a book of poems that would become We Are Going in 1964 by Kath Walker, later Ujiru Noonuckle. Ujiru's volume was the first published book of poetry by an Indigenous Australian. It was dismissed by literary critics who had their standards but remained deaf to the call of history. Wright, however, immediately grasped the significance of Ujiru's work. She was often decades ahead of her fellows. She wrote The Koori Voice, A New Literature, in 1973, while other critics could only grimace at what they termed a childlike earnestness in the poems of Ujiru and Jack Davis. Wright was able to see the radical significance of the new Aboriginal writing. She was also at the forefront of environmental awareness, being in 1962 one of the founders of the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland, and they needed it. Joe Bielke was premier. In 1964, the same year that Ujiru's We Are Going was published, she became president of the Wildlife Preservation Society and served for 12 years, and that took her to the forefront of some of Australia's major environmental campaigns, Barrier Reef, for example. And as well as being an environmental activist, she also wrote We Call for a Treaty in 1985, which traced the work of the Aboriginal Treaty Committee on which she had served for the previous 5 years. She was raised in the bosom of New England squatocracy. She was able to see firmly what everyone else was trying desperately and constantly to forget. She prized herself from the pioneering family myths that seek to remove responsibility and guilt, and she set off on a path to see the world for what it is. The recognition that she was born of conquerors was something Wright met with decisive courage. Her instinct was never to wring her hands or offer empty platitudes, but to set out a path of repair. The treaty she wanted, 1985, is still being called for. And later this year, we are facing a referendum on voting. In 2017, there was the First Nations Constitutional Convention, in which 250 Indigenous delegates met at Uluru and produced what you've got in front of you, the Uluru Declaration. And it's got three chief objectives. One, voice to Parliament. Two, treaty. Three, truth-telling. The statement references the 1967 referendum. The voice would be a new body that represents First Nation people across Australia to provide their input into federal government decisions, policies and laws. This would be on matters social, spiritual and economic. The voice would be an advisory body and have no power to overrule Parliament. The actual structure would depend on legislation after a yes vote in the referendum. However, a comprehensive report co-authored by Professors Tom Calmer and Marcia Langton suggests that it would be made up of two parts, local and regional voices, and the national one. The voice aims to give Indigenous people all around the country a say in government policy, and the brief was to be guided by these principles: to provide independent advice to Parliament and government, to be chosen by First Nation people based on local communities, to be representative of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island communities, and to be community-led, accountable, transparent. As an advisory body to the Parliament, the voice is only there to provide advice. It's not there to deliver services, manage government funding, or mediate between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations. The referendum on the proposed law is to alter the Constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. And it's going to be set up as a yes-no. Do you approve of this alteration? So, if the referendum is successful, the voice will be enshrined in the Constitution, meaning successive governments can't overturn it. If it fails, the Constitution remains unchanged. Indigenous advocate Noel Pearson says a rejection of the voice would represent a failure of a whole generation of Indigenous leadership. It's more than one, I think. Saying it would be then up to the new generation to chart a different way forward. He said he'd fall silent if the nation voted no. So who is pushing the no vote? In November last year, Nationals leader David Littleproud announced that his party would oppose the voice, arguing it wouldn't deal with real issues. The Liberal Party followed suit in early April. Opposition leader Peter Dutton said that his party supported recognition of First Nations people in the Constitution, but not a constitutionally enshrined consultative body. He said the party didn't believe a new body would lead to meaningful change for Indigenous Australians. Creating another body out of Canberra, as the Prime Minister is proposing, doesn't unite, and it won't deliver outcomes on the ground, he said. And some Indigenous people are supporting a no vote. Early in May, two campaigns pushing for a no vote merged. One was led by Warren Mundine, Recognising a Better Way, and the other by Jacinta Price, that was Fair Australia. They're both now called Australians for Unity. Senator Napinjimpa Price and Mr Mundine are the key spokespeople for the campaign. So you can see, the campaign, the debate, has been politicised a great deal. Now, my view is, look at the Libs and say, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? And then look at Labor and say, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? What have they ever done and what are they doing? My own view is that because the voice has no power of veto and won't be administering funds or delivering services, it won't be a magnet for the corrupt. It will appeal more to reformists than opportunists. There are no guarantees for its efficacy. I guess I'm in the nothing ventured, nothing gained camp. It may or may not pave the way for a treaty. It may well facilitate truth-telling, the third objective of the Uluru Statement. Currently, less than 4% of the population are of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander descent. They are not, like the rest of us, immigrants. They were and are dispossessed Indigenous. And like dispossessed Indigenous people everywhere else in the world, they suffer very long-term consequences. Now, our democracy demands an approximation to one person, one vote. And in that respect, we are better served by our electorates than the USA is with their federal representation. Think Dakota, less than 3 million. California, more people than live in Australia. Now, the voice will not upset representation. It's not giving 3.8% of the population more decision-making power than the rest of the population, because it's not a decision-making body. Its purpose is to inform and advise the Parliament. You may surmise that I don't have much time for the notion that the Indigenous voice will destroy our democracy. Current lobby groups who inform and advise can and do damage our democracy by offering post-parliamentary jobs for the boys who follow their advice. The reason for trying to create a channel for more information and vision is because the current system isn't succeeding in improving the disgraceful health and incarceration rates of Indigenous people. And the status quo is making it especially hard for Indigenous people who do succeed. Think of the media storms that frequently erupt when Indigenous academics and sports stars and media personalities try to make their voices heard. Casual racism, like casual sexism, has real political consequences, as well as wearing people down and subjecting them to the gratuitous abuse from total strangers. But all my ramblings aside, an informed vote is a good vote. In the 2022 elections, that's last year, an unprecedented 11 people of Aboriginal descent made it into federal parliament, some senators and some in the House of Reps. If you go online and type in, there are 11 First Nations MPs and senators, here's what they think of a voice to parliament, you can click on a photo of each of them and read what they have to say. And they're not all yes. That will give you a clearer idea on how to vote than trying to listen to long interviews on the subject. In addition, the Electoral Commission, which is independent of political parties, will send every enrolled household a pamphlet containing the arguments for and against. These pamphlets will also contain the details of the proposed constitutional change. Now, I'm going to finish today with it's a little poem that was written by Judith Wright to Kath Walker, and it ends with a wry poet-to-poet joke. Kathy, my sister with the torn heart, I don't know how to thank you for your dreamtime stories of joy and grief written on paper bark. You were one of the dark children I wasn't allowed to play with. Riverbank campers, the wrong colour. I couldn't turn you white. So it was late I met you. Late I began to know they hadn't told me the land I loved was taken out of your hands. I am born of the conquerors, you of the persecuted, raped by rum and an alien law, progress and economics. Are you and I and a once loved land peopled by tribes and trees, doomed by traders and stock exchanges, bought by faceless strangers? And you and I are bought and sold. Our songs and stories too, though quoted low in a falling market, publishers shake their heads at poets. Very wry. But we'll finish today with the benediction. The words are from Michael Schuller. Cherish your doubts, for doubt is the servant of truth. Question your convictions, for beliefs too tightly held strangle the mind and its natural wisdom. Suspect all certitudes, for the world's on nothing abides yet in our inner rooms, full of doubt, inquiry, and suspicion. Let a corner be reserved for trust. Indeed, this is the small corner where we connect and reconnect with each other.
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.